Hello, I'm Carrie Gard, and welcome to Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders.
We are live. Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders coming to you for the fourth time, third time live here. I'm so grateful for Deanna for taking a leap of faith with me. We're going to make this happen. It's going to be awesome. I want to give folks a few minutes to recognize that we're live and oh, they're somewhere else they're supposed to be. Let them join us as they will. As you get here, please say hello. I am monitoring the comments. I can't see if you're here unless you tell me so. It's like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Bueller. Bueller, come on, let us know you're here. We're excited for your questions. And so we want to give you a few minutes to get into the room and settle down. As you do that, as you come join us, I'm going to give you my take based off of Deanna's LinkedIn profile, which is a great lesson that we all get to learn and how to not judge a book by its cover. So often when we're hiring people, we look at their LinkedIn profiles and we say whether they are or they aren't. And this was one of those moments where I was like, nope, not a fit because she's a CEO and she owns an agency and that's not going to work for me. And then I got hit up again that say, no, I think Deanna's a really good fit for you. And I was like, no, I really don't think so. And then the third time's a charm, and I actually looked at her LinkedIn profile and dug into the nooks and crannies and said, oh, actually, where she is today wasn't where she was yesterday. And she would be an amazing fit for the Tech Marketing Leaders podcast. And I'm so grateful. And I'm so grateful for Deanna for your publicist to keep tapping me on the shoulder and go, no, she needs to be on your show. And me going, maybe. And then me going, oh, yes, actually.
Well, no pressure now, right?
No, well, this is the beauty is I feel like, this has totally nothing to do with our topic, but it's just all heart and part of the game of hiring, right? We tend to just immediately look at people's profiles and say or they will or they won't and bypass them, but really like giving them a chance to tell their stories, which is what this podcast is all about, uncovers the fact that actually they've had quite the experience and the life and the career, and we should understand more before we just go, nope, not a fit. So I'm grateful. Deanna, I'm gonna try my best to give a very high level of the career you've had. And then I'm really more interested in your story of how you got to where you are. So Deanna is the CEO of Growth Mode Marketing, a demand generation agency focused on driving long-term growth. I know you're all looking at me like I have 10 heads because you're like, well, don't you own an agency? And this is curious. Well, like I said, don't judge a book by its cover, y'all. So what really interested me in Deanna was her previous life around her, she's I generally on the show have VPs and CMOs and marketing managers of brands, B2B specifically, even better if they're in cybersecurity. And guess what? Deanna checks all of the above. So that's why she's here today. She started Growth Mode over 7 years ago, but she's been the VP of marketing at Great Bay Software. She's been the director of marketing at Sajan. No, I didn't say that right. You're going to correct me. It's going to be great. A marketing manager at Concur, and before that, a marketing manager at Ceridian, and that's only half of her resume. So, given her history and background, I just had to have her join me and share her story. So, I'm excited. Deanna, I mean, that was logistics, but like, you tell us your story. Tell us your story, Deanna. What do you do, and how did you get there?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Carrie, today I have Growth Mode Marketing, which is a B2B marketing agency. We focus in demand generation. But prior to that, I lived on the corporate side. I actually worked in the cybersecurity space. My last stop was VP of marketing at Great Bay Software, which had a network security solution for uncovering endpoints on a network and identifying those risks. So I know how challenging that market is, and I know how often those tech buyers get hit up. I mean, they're really the most targeted role within an organization. So surprised they don't respond to marketing as well as some other industries. It, like, the struggle is real. Right. But, you know, prior to being in agency life, I worked on the corporate side, always in the technology space and marketing, and kind of grew my career learning all the different parts of marketing. And the last couple of spots where I landed, you know, I learned a lot when I was at Ceridian and Concur and, you know, all the places before that. You know, I've been around for a while, so I've got a lot of places that I've been. But I got to Sagen and I was building the marketing department from scratch. And I built it up. I built an SDR team out. I built out the marketing. I helped them grow twice the size in about 4 years with a very scrappy marketing budget, which then landed me in the cybersecurity world at Great Bay Software as a VP of marketing, where I was doing the same thing, coming in, building up the marketing function from scratch, putting the foundation in place, helping them look at how do we grow rapidly in the next few years so that we can be acquired. As I was a VP of marketing, I was going out to agencies because this market was really hard to, you know, get the attention of buyers. And I didn't have a huge staff because the organization, you know, they were looking at being acquired down the road. So they didn't want a lot of fixed costs. So they're like, here's a marketing budget. You can hire some marketing people. You can hire an SDR team. We can build this out, but you're never going to have a 40-person marketing department. So find some partners that can help you execute on some of this work. I was going out looking at all the different agencies, and I'm in Minnesota, you know, so I was looking locally at the B2B agencies there, and I was looking nationally, and I was so frustrated with my experience because I would talk to these different agencies and they'd be like, yes, we specialize in B2B. And then you take a step back and look at their portfolio of business, and 80% or greater of their portfolio was actually B2C. And in my mind, you're not a specialist. That's a side gig to bring in more revenue.
Yeah.
There just weren't as many B2B agencies out there. And the ones that I was talking to had come in who I'd be like, help, we need leads, we need them yesterday. I need someone to help me think through this and really build out this strategy and ultimately execute on it. And they would come back and they'd be like, we're going to create this beautiful brand experience for you. Oh, and I'm like, yeah, right? And I'm like, hold up. I just told you my problem is I need more leads. I am a marketer. I understand the value of brand building very well, but this is not the conversation that I wanted to have with you. Like, they could have talked about it in a much different way and still gotten the point across, right? And so I was really frustrated, you know, just wasn't finding agencies that understood what it was like to sit on the corporate side and have to answer to the board of directors and the investors and justify every marketing dollar that I was spending and how it was going to ultimately help the company, you know, get to 10x in value within a few years. So I went to lunch with a former colleague and we had a conversation, and she was just coming off of a software company as a VP of marketing there. And she said, Deanna, I'm having the same experiences with agencies. There's got to be a better way to do this, or someone out there who gets what it's like to have those pressures and to live on the other side and not just create pretty beautiful branding stuff. So we decided to start an agency, and 8 years later, that's where I am today, is, you know, we focus on B2B tech and demand generation.
I feel like our lane, like we just sort of missed each other in the midst of things. We've been B2B and tech since 2011, doing what you're talking about, but we were lost in the sea of all the things. So I'm glad we're having this conversation today. Some of the things you mentioned is when you've experienced the different parts of marketing, as a marketing manager, as a VP, marketing's huge. What sort of like your personal, like we're all marketers at heart. We all have like a sweet spot of the things we love doing. So for you, like, even though you're an agency owner now and you probably have a completely different role, which I can completely relate to, but like, where's your heart at in terms of like, if you could get your hands dirty again, like get lost in the sauce, where would you go and what would you do?
Yeah, you know, I love digging into strategy and I do love building things from scratch from a marketing standpoint, because when you walk in an organization that hasn't built out a marketing foundation yet, they don't have team members building marketing, they've got a scrappy website that you cringe at, their brand is ugly, it looks like, you know, their eighth grader did it in his intro to design class. I love going into those companies and really thinking through like, okay, if our mission is high growth, what are the things that we have to do and how do we get scrappy about it? Because not everybody has those big budgets. I mean, I feel like I worked at both big companies and small companies in my career prior to going into the agency side, where I got to see, here's what it's like to have really big budgets and really big brand awareness. And you go to a trade show and they spend $500,000 alone just on the presence at the trade show. And then I've been at the organizations where they're like, we're $20 million. Here's your $300,000 budget. Good luck. We have to grow by 30% year over year for the next 3 years. And you're like, okay, you know, so in my heart, I have a special place for those smaller, scrappy companies that have these big aspirations to grow, but don't have the budget to back it. And I think, you know, where I have found the success in my career is where I have got really creative with the strategies that you put into place. And how do you build that awareness in the market and that trust in your brand when you don't have the dollars to put behind it?
Do you have any examples, any like favorite stories of where you've been able to do that you can share with us? Bring it to life for us.
Yeah. You know, I'll talk about Sagen because that was kind of a turning point in my career where I came in as the sole marketer and they didn't know what they wanted for marketing. They were just like, hey, can you do some newsletters, create a little bit of collateral, stuff like that. And I didn't have much of a budget. They never were going to have much of a budget. And it was a very, very competitive market. They were selling basically like a translation management system technology combined with translation. So think like you're creating marketing content, you're creating product literature. All of those things have to be translated into, say, 30 different languages. Mm-hmm. There are a ton of translation agencies. There are dime a dozen. They all use contract workers from around the world. They're using the same contract world workers. So there's not a lot of competitive differentiators there. And yet they were like, all right, we have to make our mark. We want to compete with the big guys. And nobody had more than like 1% market share in the entire market because it was so big and cluttered. And I went in there and really had to get creative and think about how do we create that brand awareness and stand out from all of the others that are out there. You know, we're never going to be, you know, within 2 years, the leader in this space. But right, there's enough business out there to go and make a name for ourselves. And honestly, I threw all of my money and all of my efforts and building out my team into building a really, really strong content marketing strategy, which is kind of, you know, the foundation of, you know, what we call demand generation today. So I was putting marketing automation in place before marketing automation was the norm. I was going to LinkedIn groups and we were creating brand ambassadors within the company that were going and posting in these groups, and we were regularly publishing content of our own, and we were getting things placed, you know, through content syndication and all those things. And, you know, we were able in about 3 to 4 years with not enough marketing dollars, quite frankly, to go from 14 million to 30 million. So we were able to double in that time, you know, which I look at and I'm like, in hindsight, that was pretty darn impressive considering I didn't get much money to spend. And when I did spend, I honestly chose to hire people to help create the content versus going out and doing a ton of digital advertising and hiring an agency and all of those things. So that's probably my favorite story of my career pre-agency life.
It's a good one. And it shows just the power of content. And I don't think that's changed. I think that's really where we all circle back to. Like, mm-hmm. we think we gotta go do these other things, but at the end of the day, we have to have good content to fuel those other things we wanna do. Like, if we wanna go on LinkedIn, if we wanna do advertising, if we wanna have good SEO, if we wanna have influencer programs, if we wanna have communities, like, at the end of the day, you need really strong content at its core to make any of that happen. And so,
yeah,
that's yes to that being one of the first things you, even if it's the only, if it's the only thing you can do.
Right. And I think the whole content play has amplified in the last few years, because if you look at the way B2B buyers are purchasing these days, you know, the statistics are coming out of Gartner, and we've seen this with the companies that we work with at Growth Mode Marketing. People are not as responsive as they were to cold outreach, to cold calls, to email campaigns, to digital ads, you know, and it's very frustrating for companies who are like, the things that we did in the past are not getting the results. And, you know, we had this blueprint, tried and true, tested, you know, you think about the tech industry, like everybody builds out SDR teams. And now you're telling me that 72% of B2B prospects would prefer to have zero interaction with a sales rep during the purchase process. They're making up to 80% of that purchase decision before they'll even engage with a sales rep, which means if you're an SDR and you're cold calling, you know, the math works against mm-hmm. you, right? Because now you have, like, the vast majority of people are doing everything they can to avoid talking to a sales rep, and the SDR is another step in that process. And so, you know, when you and I had talked previously, Carrie, we talked about how, you know, your digital footprint needs to become your best salesperson or your best SDR. Essentially, what we're saying is, okay, if they're going to go, the prospect, and make up to 80% of their decision, they're researching mostly digitally online content that's out there that exists for you to decide who to shortlist.
We're going to get there. That is the name of the game. We're going to talk about your digital marketing needs to become the SDR footprint. Before we get there, though, Deanna, I do want to know, is that, what's the current challenge you're facing? Is that really it in terms of helping your clients make that digital footprint? Is there something else happening for you that's sort of top of mind? What, you know, we're all human and life is hard, and it's a whole new world that we live in. Right. So currently it's like your primary challenge.
Yeah, you know, I think it's all around, like, how do you grow as a company and how do you build revenue? And when you look at it from a demand generation standpoint and take a step back, I think there's a few factors that need to be considered that a lot of companies are getting wrong. One, I think a lot of companies are trying to be everything to everybody. Meaning, let's say you're selling a cybersecurity software and you're looking at it and you're saying, basically anyone with 50 employees has how many endpoints on their network coming in, they're a good fit for our solution. However, so are the other 200 vendors that are coming with the exact same message, right? And so I really yeah. think that you have to define an ideal customer profile. And that's scary to a lot of company leaders and salespeople and marketers, quite frankly, because they're looking at it and they're saying, hold up, so you're telling me I need to make my audience that I market to smaller? It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, but step back and think about it. If I'm an organization that's selling my cybersecurity solution to everybody, I'm going to come in sounding like everybody because it's going to be a message that's trying to appeal to the masses, right? On the flip side, if I said I'm going to focus in on hospital systems, now my messaging is around how, you know, it's life-threatening if there's a data breach and someone breaks into your network and they can start to control the systems that are within a hospital. Telling that story is going to resonate much more with that buyer in the hospital system than it is if you just came in and said, we can protect your network. We can help you identify where the risks are and not let those, you know, endpoints into your network.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting lost in the sea of sameness when you're trying to be everything to everyone. So really, if you narrow down your focus and you really, from a marketing standpoint, design everything to speak to that audience specifically, that hyper focus of a narrow audience will actually get you higher growth.
And that's like the challenge you're currently facing, is trying to convince brands that they need to really like hone in on exactly
helping them understand that. And then also the whole like differentiators, you know, every company tries to come up with, here's how we're different. And what I have seen in the tech space, in the cybersecurity space, you know, in the broader tech space, is a lot of times they don't have true meaningful differentiators that are valuable to the buyer. And what happens then is they start to come up with differentiators like, our customer service is exceptional, our technology integrates with a lot of other platforms, our onboarding process has ease, you know, the list goes on and on. If you stop and think about it, those are table stakes. Those are things buyers expect from you, but they're certainly not like real differentiators, because let's be honest, anybody, any company can say we have exceptional customer service. So
yeah, it's very vaporware-y.
Right. You know, so the question that we try to help clients answer, you know, that again, I think is a challenge for them to really wrap their arms around in the beginning before they go into the process, is how do you sound different in the market when you're not technically different in the eyes of the buyer and your technology doesn't have enough differentiation to really make that stand out?
Yes, I think a lot of folks that are now coming into cybersecurity, especially, you know, startups, they also are started at the same point of just sort of who could get to the market faster. Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to, you know, we're going to talk about this in a second in terms of the SDR, you know, make your digital footprint your next SDR. And it's just putting it back in the hands, which is terrifying, but also reality, into the hands of your buyer and letting them make the decision. Which I think lends nicely, because I have a lot of questions around the SDR and relationship building. So when I first got started in digital advertising and digital marketing, it was as a media planner back in 2007. So totally dating myself right now, and I accept that. And as a media planner, we had print folks knocking down our door, left, right, and center, for us to sell. I was working on Verizon Wireless at the point. And so they wanted us to put our ads into their magazines, right? And the people who showed up in the middle of my day and tried to bring me coffee and donuts, I was like, I want to murder you right now. I'm trying to get work done. Can you please be anywhere else? But the sales folks who was like, I want to take you out tonight. You've worked really hard. Let's go get a massage. Let's go make shoes at Nike, because that's cool. It's something you'll never get to do anywhere else. And you know what? On another instance, we're going to go learn how to trapeze, because you're a young media buyer and that's mm-hmm. something you'll remember for the rest of your life, right? And they gave me these experiences. And I know exactly to this day, I remember the publisher and I remember the person who took me on all of those experiences. And it was the same person who did the trapeze, the Nikes, to the massages. And she was building relationships with every single one of us along the way, using that as a moment to get to know us and what we're passionate about, what we love. And she was building these relationships as an SDR. And then there's just been this shift around, like, it's not that long. It's 10, 15 years that's now about cold calls and emails and bombardment and digital and how we can scale and how fast we can do this. And like the relationship piece has gotten so thrown out the window. And so I just feel like in what you're talking about, the first thing I want to sort of establish, you know, buying is wild. Yes, it's a wild, wild west over there. The first thing I want to establish is to you, like, who is the SDR now? And what are the responsibilities? But what should they be? Like, what are they expected to do right now? But really, what should they be expected to do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Carrie. So, you know, in my experience, I've managed, built from scratch a couple of different SDR teams. And, you know, I know the drill, you know, at least back in the day, you would hire them, you'd give them a list, you'd give them some email templates. And it's kind of like, all right, have at it. We need you to get 20 appointments per month, you know, and then you hand them over to the sales rep. I think the way that they've done it in the past, I mean, what I'm hearing from other people that still have SDR teams, they're like, oh, it's a grind. You know, they're not finding as many opportunities as they did in the past. People seem to be more resistant. And I think part of it is, you know, because the way people buy has changed. And like, I just saw some data yesterday on LinkedIn from a company called Toriel that did a study with 560 software purchases. And what they found were 80% of B2B buyers say they self-educate as much as they possibly can when evaluating software solutions. Self-educate to me means don't call me SDR. I want to figure this out on my own, right? You know, and 83% feel most B2B SaaS websites don't provide all the info they need before a demo. And 84% expressed frustration over being forced to speak with a sales rep to see the product. Well, I don't know about you, Carrie, but I've had clients who have told me like they will build a whole marketing strategy around book a demo. And when you ask them why, they're like, because if we can get someone to see a demo, they have a much higher conversion rate because they're impressed by our software product. It's like, that makes sense. But someone who's willing to see a demo is pretty far along that decision process, right? Like they're not just randomly like, sure, I'll see 20 different demos from 20 different vendors. The problem with that, if you think about the SDR model, you know, if they're chasing after these people, they're trying to pull people into the sales process. And the way people, you know, from a prospect side are buying now, they don't want to be pulled into the sales process. They want to invite you into their buying process when they raise their hand and say, I am ready to have a conversation with you. So I think that means organizations really need to step back and think about the role of the SDR and how do you make those individuals successful to ultimately make the sales team successful versus the old model, which was, you know, like, let's say you have a report, a research study that you did that you're putting out to your customers and you're running digital ads, you put forms in front of those trying to collect leads. Now the SDR is following up with them. They're flipping those leads as appointments over to sales, and sales is saying, these aren't closing. These people don't actually have buying intent. That's a lot of time and money that's being spent on SDRs chasing down, you know, marketing qualified leads that aren't actually going to have a very good close rate, you know, and it's frustrating for everybody involved because everyone's working really hard to find those appointments, to pass them to sales, to try to turn it into something. And I think it's a lot of wasted time and energy and ultimately dollars for organizations to make those investments if it's not converting to business the way that it needs to be. So going back to your question, Carrie, about how does that change for the SDR, I think we need to look at the fact that people are doing a ton of research and digging in a lot more and trying to figure out the answers on their own versus engaging with a sales rep. And it really does become how do you be seen as an asset who's providing valuable information to the prospect without infringing on their desire to not engage with a sales rep, right? So, you know, it probably takes more time, more personalized outreach, like really digging in and understanding that prospect. And instead of trying to be the pushy, you know, sales, let's book an appointment, it's like, here's some information I thought would be valuable based on the research I've done and what I know about you.
Yes, I do think that the SDR role has to shift. And we'll get into the marketing piece of how marketing can support that. I'm sort of talking about the bottom of the funnel and then working our way up here. I do think, going back to my original story, there's something about bringing relationship back into the fold that I think is missing for SDRs, where they have a huge opportunity right now to reach out and say, how can I help? Or listening to what's actually happening in the market. There's a really great sales rep out there for another digital marketing agency, Infuse, Trevor Van Worden, who's doing exactly that. He's looking at the market and he's saying, what do marketers need right now? They need connection. They need help. They need to feel and hear from each other, and we need to elevate one another. And so he's gone out and created LinkedIn Live campaigns similar to this, but more about how can we call other people out who are doing great work and create this beautiful network. And it's totally free of like anything. He's not trying to sell at the end of the day. He's just right. Seeing a need within the market and trying to create connection. And Trevor. And I think there's real beauty in SDRs being able to fill that human void that both marketing and sales are sort of caught in between of. And going back to that relationship building that I mentioned early on, like this has gone away, and COVID's certainly an aspect of that, taking people out and making, you know, in-person relationships and building rapport there has been really tough, especially remotely, but I think it can come back, and I think it can be done really, really well. And I think marketing can help bring in the initial right people who might look like those folks, and then the relationships can be cultivated and then handed off to sales is sort of how I'm starting to feel like the shift. So let's talk about the marketing piece now, because I do think marketing plays a huge piece in this. And I think that there's a new shift as well that I'm really excited about, that I'd love your intake on, around sales and marketing used to like fight each other. I still think there's a little bit of friction. Yeah. But I think it's like a little bit. So what's been your experience in watching this sort of relationship unfold between marketing and sales? Because I think that's a big piece to making this whole puzzle work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, sales and marketing butting heads is a tale as old as time, right? Like everybody says we're perfectly aligned. And then as soon as the revenue is down and we're not hitting those revenue targets, that's where like tensions get high. And, you know, I can tell you, I've had teams before that would, you know, come and plop down a team member in my office and be like, I'm so frustrated. Everything we do is to help the sales team be successful. But when they're doing really well, they're saying it's because they're exceptional salespeople. When they're not doing well, they're saying it's because marketing isn't doing their job. And I feel no appreciation. And I'm like, welcome to marketing. You're never going to get the glory, my friend. Like, just accept it and do what you can to make, you know, the right decisions to support this organization. I think, you know, when you look at the shifting tides right now, you know, in the tech space, what we're seeing with companies is they're pulling back on marketing spend, which means, hey, our revenue's down. Great idea. Why don't we cut our marketing budget? The very engine that creates brand awareness and trust for us so that we make the short list. So they raise their hand and say, I'm willing to talk to a sales rep. The flip side is the sales team is getting more pressure to deliver because with this economy, it's harder. I mean, if you think in a normal year, 5% of the total addressable market are actually in market to buy at any given time. When there are tough economic times and companies are pulling back spend, guess what? It's now 1%, which means their job just got harder as sales reps because they're trying to uncover these opportunities without the marketing support to be able to do it. So I think, you know, that creates some of the tension is, you know, we're measured on different things at times that don't necessarily align. Marketing is trying to look at the long term. How do we build brand awareness and growth? And, you know, they're looking like 18 months down the road, right? Well, sales is looking at this month, this quarter. Like, I need to meet my revenue number now. And so I feel like from an alignment standpoint, where that misstep happens is if you're in an organization that says marketing needs to meet a certain MQL number, or, you know, in organizations I worked at where I managed the SDR team, the SDRs reported into marketing. We had to meet certain numbers of how many appointments we were setting per SDR every single month. Well, guess what you focus on? You focus on quantity because that's what you're being asked to do. The problem is now you're handing it to sales and marketing saying, okay, close it. This is a great opportunity for you. And sales is pushing back and saying, these leads are crap. I can't be held accountable because you guys are sending bad leads. And you've got sales marketing saying, we did what we were asked to do. You can't hold us accountable because you're not capable of closing those leads, right? Like, so it's, we're all working towards the same thing. We want to help the company achieve its revenue targets, but we're measured on different things. And I think that's where the headbutting and the finger pointing tends to happen.
It's so true. Quincy Johnson, I'm grateful you're here and for your father. Yes to marketing quotas all day and building campaigns in Canva. That's a whole different conversation that we might have time for today. But yes, I appreciate what you're saying, Deanna, in that we're on different playing fields because we're all trying to hit different targets depending on what they are. We're marketing's told to deliver volume and sales is told to deliver revenue. So should we be all working towards the same metric? And if so, what should that metric be?
Yeah, in my opinion, yes. And ultimately, you know, as marketers, we've been kind of trained, you have to justify every dollar you spend, you have to be able to show growth and tie the ROI back to marketing programs. And hey, we'll give you more budget if you can prove that it's working, right? So we've gotten very metrics focused, like what can I measure? How do I tell that story? I think there needs to be a step back from some of that to really take a good look and say, okay, quantity can't be the only measurement. Quality has to come before quantity. And so if sales and marketing are truly going to be aligned and rowing in the same direction, what we need to be measured on ultimately together is the pipeline and the revenue. Because at the end of the day, let's face it, revenue is the only thing that matters. You know, and I know I've had people say before, well, don't you think profitability matters? Absolutely. That's not something that marketing gets to have a lot of influence on, but we can influence the revenue piece. And at the end of the day, I guarantee you, if the company is hitting its revenue targets and growing at the rate that they've been asked to grow at, your CEO, your investors, your board of directors are not going to come back to you and say, how many website visitors did we have? What's your open rate on your emails? You know, they care about the end number. And that means everything, you know, from a marketing standpoint, from a sales standpoint, like we've all got to be paying attention to that end number. And marketing needs to own it too, because we're having an influence on it. And if we're not, you know, that's probably where the budgets get cut and the positions get cut in marketing when times are tight, because you're not showing the value and that you're really in it to help the company achieve the ultimate goal.
I will say yes to that, and two things. One is it's getting harder to, it feels like brands won it yesterday. Like, it's easy to talk about for more the enterprise and the mid-level who are a bit more established. Like, yes, 100%, we should all be measuring revenue. Let's go. For the startups and the just getting started, yes. And what are the key KPIs we need right now to start working towards that? Because you need to wire it up. You need to feed enough data through it to actually know what's happening. So I think yes and to that. We all need to be held accountable to revenue when these things are in place and we have enough data flowing through the system. We have to get better. Quincy Johnson, we have to get better as marketers at communicating up to CEOs that keeps their hands out of the strategic pot. Yes. Yeah, so it's tough. They're answering to the board and they don't have these answers. And so they're coming to us with these really tough questions. And if we don't have really solid answers, that's like with time frames and you know, those types of things of how much revenue they can expect when, those are really tough conversations to put the CEO in. So yes, Quincy, I totally agree. And we need that data to know that. In terms of marketing and how marketing can help sales now, right? So if the SDR and we're all working towards revenue and we're all in the same boat rowing, how can marketing help sales if it's not about leads? Or maybe it is. You tell me, Deanna, in terms of your experience, like, how do you create that digital footprint?
Yeah. So when I talk about you have to create a digital footprint that becomes your best sales rep or your best SDR, basically what I mean is if you look at the fact that prospects are making up to 80% of that purchase decision before they're willing to engage with a sales rep, marketing has to carry more of the load in convincing them for that 80% until they're willing to say, okay, I'll talk to you now. That means you've got to be very targeted, you know who your ideal customer profile is, create a unique point of view that resonates with that ideal customer profile, and then create the content engine to create content that's very hyper-focused for that audience, telling the story, and you get it out everywhere where they're hanging out. So knowing that people are doing so much of their research online and gathering information, I think there's three kind of pillars that you should be looking at. One, your website. If someone comes to your website as a prospect, do you have enough information that they can make 80% of their decision on there? And it kind of goes back to that stat from Turiel that, you know, 80 something percent of people were frustrated that they can't see a demo on your site, that they have to actually engage with a sales rep to do it. So look at putting that type of content on there, not just the blog posts and the podcasts and the, you know, top of funnel type of content. But if I want to dig deep and I want to understand how your products and your services work, give me that information, put it out there. Stop being afraid that your competitors are going to see it and do something with it. If they really want that information, trust me, they can get it. Right? And honestly, like, is anything you have so earth-shattering that your competitor can turn around and replicate it tomorrow? I highly doubt it, right? So make your website really good. Make it so people have a reason to stay on your website and continue to dig in. Put content loops on there, meaning I look at topic XYZ at the end of the article, there's links to more of your content on those topics. So that instead of jumping off and Googling and looking at the next company, they just keep reading your content and going deeper and kind of building that trust in these people know what they're doing at this company. This is a product that sounds like it would work for my needs. The second
foundation.
The second is building out your audience through managed channels. And what I mean by managed channels, that's any marketing channel where you can control what you put out there, when you put it out there, and how often you put it out there. So think about social media channels, blogs, webinar series, podcasts, email campaigns, digital advertising. You have control over all of that. And the goal is, like, as you're putting that stuff out there, like, let's use this podcast as an example. You're trying to build an audience that wants to continually follow the content that you're putting out there because they find value in it and it's interesting to them. And then that third channel is third-party channels. How do you tap into relevant existing audiences that other people have built up? And if you don't have brand awareness, if you're in the startup phase or you haven't been in the game long and you don't have your own audience built up, you might actually want to start with somebody else's audience. And that means looking at, you know, who are influencers within the industry? What are publications within the industry? What are resources within the industry where your ideal customer profile is hanging out? And how do you tap into that? How do you build out review sites where people are reviewing your content or your product? How do you have other people writing about your company, your product? How do you, you know, do all these things to get in front of them from a third-party perspective? And some of it's pay to play, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, like you can... You can purchase other people's email lists. You can get on their podcasts. You can sponsor webinars that they put on. I mean, there's a lot of things out there. And some of it, which is a little harder to find, but it exists, are you can also do it without any added costs. So, for example, you know, going on a tour and being a podcast guest, right? Like, yes, you can hire someone to go find those opportunities for you. But most of the time, there's not going to be a cost to be on someone else's podcast if you can bring value for them.
It's kind of like the story of pick two against three, right? Do you have time? Mm-hmm. Do you have money? Or do you need quality? Right? Yeah. We can all agree that we need quality at the end of the day. So that's so it's just a matter of whether do you have time or do you have money?
Yeah,
and some people have more time if they're a startup and they're growing and they can get a head start. And other people are like, great, we have a product and our investors are telling us we need to move like yesterday. You're probably gonna need some cash to like amp that up, and so it's the threefold. Let's unpack some of this, Deanna, because the web is a big worldwide thing, and I love what you're saying in terms of breaking it down into three clear buckets. And where should people start? Because we can't do it all, right? It's something you said earlier on, like when you show up and you're trying to be everything to everybody, you're nothing to no one. So in your experience, and I know that it depends on all of the things, but in general, in your experience, where should brands start when it comes to their online presence, their audience, and those third-party channels?
Yeah, honestly, if you're starting from scratch, you really have to do the strategy piece. You have to define who is that ideal customer profile. You have to determine what is our unique point of view in the market, and then build that blueprint for how you're going to execute it. And I know this feedback from this because I do hear this from companies from time to time. They're like, yeah, Deanna, I get the strategy piece, but we need results today. And I just want to get into the tactical stuff. Well, guess what? When you skip the strategy, you're all over the place. I like to call it random acts of marketing because it's like, ooh, let's try this and let's try this and how about this and have we done this?
To get against the wall.
Right. Let's shoot 1,000 bullets before we send a cannonball out because we'll want to see what sticks. Mm-hmm. I get the thinking behind that, but what all these random acts of marketing equate to is not optimized results. You're not going to grow as fast because you weren't hyper-focused. And so I think it's really important to call out, like, don't skip the strategy piece. I hear it all the time. People don't want to spend money on the strategy. They just want to dive into the things. Well, if you're building a demand generation engine, you know, in full transparency, it's not going to start working tomorrow. It's going to take probably 6 to 9 months before you start to see any traction, and up to 18 months before it is a predictable humming machine with inbound leads coming in.
Let's pause there for a second, Deanna. And just for those who are listening, I'm sure we all understand what demand gen is right now, but let's just double check. Because I also hear go-to-market thrown around a lot. Demand gen, demand capture, lead gen. There's all these terms. So when you're specifically talking about demand gen, what does demand gen mean to you?
Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of people still interchange the term lead generation and demand generation. And from my perspective, they're very different strategies. Lead generation is we're trying to pull prospects into our sales process. We're asking them for a meeting. Demand generation, on the flip side, it's about focusing on the broader market, meaning we know 95% of companies are not in market right now, but we also understand that if they don't know who we are and have trust in us, when they are in that 5%, they're less likely to reach out to us. And if they've already shortlisted it, if they know you and they pick you to be on the shortlist, you probably have a 1 in 3, 1 in 5 chance of getting selected. If they didn't know you before they made their shortlist, because remember, they're making 80% of that purchase decision before they reach out, you now have probably a 1% chance of getting selected because they've already narrowed down who they want to talk to. They probably already know who they want to buy from, right? And so I think as you look at marketing and demand generation and understand, like, demand generation is about building the brand awareness and trust with companies, with individuals, so that when they are in market to buy, they raise their hand and they tap you on the shoulder. That's why it takes a while. You know, companies are still going to come back, you know, and I have been there. I have been on the corporate side where it's like, but Deanna, we need leads. We need them now. Therefore, we're going to do lead generation. I think there needs to be a transition from lead gen to demand gen. Most companies aren't in a situation where they can just say, okay, turn off all the outbound efforts, turn on the inbound. Let's wait the 18 months and see how spectacular it is for us. So you kind of have to continue to do lead gen to a point until your demand gen engine is truly up and running. And I think naturally you start to ease up on the lead gen and you start to look more at, okay, we're working on demand creation, which falls under demand generation. And now instead of lead gen, we're looking at demand capture, which falls under demand generation. That's probably a very convoluted answer.
Yeah, one starts to feed the other, right? So instead of demand, so instead of lead generation, right, we have to, like you're saying, you have to sort of pull people into it. You're generating it from top of funnel. And then when they're ready and they're raising their hand, whether that's through paid search and something super down the funnel, whether that's signing up for a demo, whether that's a straight up contact form, that's lead capture, because we're not pulling. We're just a big giant net and we're saying, we're here when you're ready. If we're ready to catch you when you're ready to make that decision. And bridge this for me, going back to our original conversation, that's almost leapfrogging SDR into sales. Or does the SDR still...
Does the SDR still truly have a role?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? If you're doing demand gen and you're getting results from it, technically these should be buyers who are demonstrating some level of buying intent. They probably should go straight to sales, because if you're adding another step and saying, okay, but wait, you have to talk to our SDR and see if you're qualified. Well, the whole qualification thing was to determine, like, do they have the budget? Do they have the authority? Do they have the timing? You know, all of those things. They've raised their hand. They said, I want to talk to a sales rep. They didn't raise their hand and say, I'd like to talk to an SDR. So you have to think about that. But, you know, honestly, I'm kind of on the fence of the role that the SDR plays, because they are near and dear to my heart. I have built those teams from scratch. I know how hard that job is. So to just throw the baby out with the bathwater, I don't think makes sense for a lot of organizations. But how do they help with the marketing piece of it, of getting people to that 80%? And I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier, Carrie, about they can help build that relationship. They can help humanize the brand by being there and being helpful and putting the right content in front of those individuals on a more one-to-one scale. And also, like, leveraging LinkedIn, for example, you know, you probably see it too. There are a lot of people these days that are really good at building a personal brand on LinkedIn that ties back to their company brand. And people follow that and they're like, I really like what that person has to say. It resonates with me. Oh, they're from XYZ company. That's interesting. Maybe I should take a look. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've actually looked up the company that someone's from and I've looked at their profile, because I constantly see their stuff in my feed and I like what they're saying. if an SDR can do that, they can help get those prospects through that 80% decision process. But that's totally different than the traditional model where they're giving quotas based on volume that they produce.
Yeah. I think tying the total marketing funnel from marketing to SDR to sales to a revenue to all encompassing revenue number, I think giving everybody a role and responsibility from marketing building top of funnel to SDR creating relationships to sales closing deals creates some clear roles and responsibilities, having everybody work together without stepping on each other's toes or working against each other. Mm-hmm. And I think it all helps essentially raise the bottom line. I think it also diversifies your funnel and not, some people do want to talk to a person. They have questions and they need somebody on the other end to answer those. And if they feel like they're reaching out to somebody who's not going to hard sell them, they're more open to doing that. You know, at the end of the day, B2B is, as Simon Chow has taught us all through Marketing on Mars, it's people to people business, right? At the end of the day, you do need that human element. And so as marketing, we're here to surround and provide and be there when somebody's needing that thing. And then the person's there on the other end to build the relationship. And then sales is there to help them make that decision and move through. So I love this. I think this is where things do need to go. I also feel like it's going a little bit back in time, which I'm good with too, of like, coming back to relationships. Like, it's been such a digital world for so long. And like, how do we scale and how do we grow and more, 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 more? And it's like, actually, to everything you're saying, Deanna, less. Yeah. Who do you need to be talking to? Who is that ICP? Let's focus on them and giving them what they need. And the rest will follow.
Yeah, it's amazing how narrowing down your focus can actually increase your results.
Sure. I'm so grateful for this conversation, Deanna. Thank you so much for joining me and riding the wave. I know you didn't know where I was going with this in the beginning, but I wanted to give SDRs a voice and let them know we're not here to trample them.
No.
We're here to help them. And I think that there's a real value for them that's a place for them to really step in and own a piece of this pie that would be incredibly valuable. So thank you for the opportunity. Before we close out, because this is B2B, because this is people to people, because you are human, I have one question for you. In the last 3 years, in the shift of the universe, we are now out and traveling again. The world has opened up. We can go wherever without all of the things. Imagine that not everybody's trying to do the same thing at once, like, get on a plane at the same time. If you could travel to anywhere without the red tape, where would you go and why?
Sorry, the clock is dinging in the background. That means time's up, right? So I just got back from a trip to Australia, which was pretty epic. So I can take that off the list. But I would say the next place I would love to go is Thailand. I just think the scenery looks amazing. I love hot and beachy, and I love Thai food. So I think that's where my next bucket list item is going to go.
Oh, well, you'll have to share your Instagram or something so we can join in your travels. That sounds amazing. And yes, to that. I'm so grateful, Deanna. Thank you so much. Thank you to our listeners. Quincy Johnson, I see you. I have a LinkedIn user. I don't know who that is, but I will follow up with you. I'm grateful for your comments. And even if you're listening and it's pre-recorded, if you have any questions, please chime in. And Deanna, when I will get back to you. As we want to hear from you and you're important to us. So thank you for joining in. This episode is brought to you by MKG Marketing, the digital marketing agency that scales brands through meaningful relationships, fueling their ability to push their mission forward. It's hosted by me, Carrie Gard, CEO and co-founder of MKG Marketing. Music mix and mastering done by Austin Ellis, once this is actually done and recorded. And if you'd like to be a guest, please visit mkgmarketing.com to apply. Deanna, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.